Covers, getting out of bed, Jurgen says, you're just asshole enough to do it.
I'm more than asshole enough. Hey, fancy pajamas.
Stuff a sock in it. 4 minutes, says Dubose. 15. In the club chair, enveloped by rose-colored light, Gavin noticed a hardcover copy of Black Orchids, a Nero Wolfe mystery by Rex Stout. There seemed to be a different Nero Wolfe novel on each table in the circle of armchairs, each with a bookmark inserted one place or another. Seeing his cousin's interest, Cornell said,
I recently read the works of the philosopher Immanuel Kant. I needed relief. Have you read the Nero Wolfe mysteries?
I've not had the chance, I'm afraid, Gavin said.
I've read all the Nero Wolfes before, said Cornell, but they bear rereading. Immanuel Kant, not so much.
Having made his fortune and been terrified by the size of it and the ease with which it had been earned, being himself disengaged from life as most people knew it, Cornell had decided to spend his remaining years, whether or not the world ended, reading about life as others had written of it.
Do you still avoid the news? Gavin asked. No newspaper, no magazines, no radio. The one TV, and I only turn it on for a minute, every day, just to see if transmissions are still occurring. If they are, the end times have not arrived, though what little glimpses I get of the current programs assure me that my prediction of societal collapse is correct. I'm prepared to wait out 30 months of barbarism between civilizations.
Like the small blue house at the front of the property, the big room inside the barn and the underground bunker were connected to the public power supply. If society collapsed, as Cornell anticipated, he could switch to a generator housed in a subterranean vault and powered by propane drawn from an immense tank buried nearby. According to his calculations, there was enough propane to operate the bunker and the barn for 14 months, because both were so well insulated that they needed little heating or cooling. If he retreated to the bunker and didn't use the barn room, he could ride out a crisis lasting 30 months.
I estimate, he said, as he'd said before, there's a 46% chance a new society will arise from the disintegration of the current one, but if after 30 months the public utilities aren't operative, they won't be restored in my lifetime, if ever.
Then what? Gavin asked, as he had asked before.
Then, the inevitable, said Cornell,
as he always said. He smiled.
So you're coming to stay in my little blue house? You need to understand the risk of taking us in. The coming collapse is the ultimate risk.
Nevertheless, you need to know a few things. Jesse and I did a favor for a friend who's wanted by the FBI.
A criminal?
A righteous fugitive.
Cornell raised one hand to stop Gavin.
Give me a thumbnail version, please and thank you. After the Nero Wolfe stories, I want to read everything written by Mr. Henry James. I liked The Turn of the Screw. Very turny. Very screwy. And he was a busy, busy author. He published more than 120 books in his lifetime, far more than you.
Thumbnail, then, it is, Gavin said. Our friend is wanted by the FBI and some really bad people. She's a widow.
Convey my condolences, please and thank you.
I will, Gavin promised. Anyway, she's afraid the people who want to kill her would also kill her son, so she hid him with us.
I would feel safe to be hidden with you, Cornell said. But I feel even safer in my bunker. No offense intended.
None taken. Anyway, the worst happened, and some people came after us. And last night we got out of the house just in time, went overland and lost them. Now we've got to lie low. I know about lying low. Sometimes people have to lie low in the Nero Wolf stories, also in those of Mr. Dashiell Hammett, and even in those of Mr. Charles Dickens. I think in particular of the escaped prisoner, Magwitch, at the beginning of Great Expectations.
Gavin leaned forward in his chair. This is real life now, Cornell.
Real bad people. A real threat. Not a story by Dickens or Dashiell Hammett. There's no meaningful difference, cousin. I think Plato might agree, except he's dead. My condolences. When I return to reading fiction, which I hope to do in just a minute or two, please and thank you, it is my real life. Now you stay in my little blue house and lie low and don't worry about me.
He accordioned up from his chair, all the pleats of his long legs and arms opening out, drawing in a deep breath in the rising, as if he might issue a squeeze-box sound. But he only sighed and said,
You already have the key to the house.
Yes. Thank you, Cornell.
Say no more. Say no more.
He put his large hands over his ears.
Say no more.
16. They take breakfast in the hotel coffee shop, which is bright and airy and elegantly appointed. The U-shaped booth is large enough for six, and DuBose sits at the deepest point of it, his back to the wall, so that no one, not even the waitress, can see the screen of his laptop. The computer on the table offends Carter Jurgen, but he doesn't complain. If he speaks up every time DuBose does something uncouth or vulgar, he will have laryngitis by noon. As he enjoys a bowl of mixed berries and clotted cream with brown sugar, Jurgen considers the mystery, not for the first time, of why his and DuBose's partnership is so successful. They rarely experience a debacle like that of the previous night. Regardless of the intensity or duration of his deliberations on this issue, Jurgen arrives always at the same conclusion, as he does now again. The very fact that he and DuBose have little in common is a considerable advantage. Just as opposites attract each other into marriage, so opposites, when paired as agents, with a license to kill, and worse, can each bring a unique perspective to any case. The problem with this explanation is that from it one must infer that, separately, each of them is in some sense an incomplete or at least unfinished person. Carter Jurgen believes himself to be complete, finished, as well-rounded as a droplet of water floating in a zero-gravity environment. In fact, he knows that he is both complete and complex, yet no other explanation occurs to him. Using the rootkits that the NSA has secretly installed in the computer networks of the major banks with which Gavin and Jessica Washington have credit cards, DuBose checks to see if they have charged anything since the unfortunate episode the previous night. They're probably too smart to make such an error, but sometimes bright and savvy people do dumb things. While he works on the laptop, Radley DuBose eats bacon with his fingers. He smacks his lips as if the fullest enjoyment of the meat requires loud, gustatory noises. Occasionally he pauses between one slice of bacon and the next to suck on the thumb and forefinger with which he held the meat to ensure that no dab of grease will escape his consumption. Jurgen finds some consolation that DuBose uses a fork to eat his cheese omelet rather than resorting again to his fingers or putting his face right down in the food.
They haven't used a credit card, DuBose says. Let's see if the plates on the rover were scanned anywhere since last night.
The manner in which DuBose eats is no more mortifying than the fact that, in addition to the bacon that comes with his omelet, he has requested 4 additional orders, 12 slices, which have been served in an obscene pile on a separate plate. When the waitress put down that mess of pork fat, she made some comment to the effect that he must be hungry, Whereupon the inimitable West Virginian winked at her lasciviously and said, "Darlin', I'm a man of voracious appetites." As if the Ritz-Carlton was the most natural place in the world to respond to an attractive woman with vulgarity. The Ritz-Carlton. Working in the NSA's archives of scanned plates, DuBose sets up time parameters and enters the license number of the Land Rover, but no police car or other government vehicle equipped with 360-degree plate scanning capability has transmitted those tags in the past 12 hours. Confounded, the big man leans back in the booth, his forehead corrugating as he contemplates his next step. And, of course, he must have another strip of bacon to grease the wheels of his mind. As Jurgen listens to the lip-smacking, he considers commenting to the effect that, until this moment, he hasn't realized DuBose indulges in cannibalism. But there's no point in getting snarky. DuBose is incapable of embarrassment. Besides, he'll only come back with some retort about Boston Brahmins or prep school or Harvard or the Hasty Pudding Club that he imagines to be witty. DuBose says, "We know from the car she had to abandon in Texas. Hawk has a sophisticated source for forged plates. They show up as a legitimate registration in state files." Having finished his berries, Carter Jurgen blots his lips with the satisfyingly substantial cloth napkin. Before picking up his cup of tea, he says, "Perhaps she gave the Washingtons a set of plates, complete with registration papers in another name, so if they ever had to go on the run, they could swap them out for the real plates."
"Great minds think alike," DuBose says, "and so do yours and mine."
"But if we don't have those plate numbers or the phony name in which she registered the Land Rover, we're still nowhere." The big man picks up two slices of bacon, folds the double thickness into his mouth in one wad, and works his brute jaws as though he is enjoying a chaw of tobacco. After he swallows, he says, "Maybe I have an idea." 17. Near Coso Junction, Jane pulled off U.S. Highway 395 and into a rest area with public lavatories. Hers was the only vehicle in the lot. The naked blue sky at the start of their journey had taken on a more modest aspect as they'd come north. Now it was a monkish gray to every horizon, looming low, with some last spell of winter weather pending. As if the flock she'd seen earlier had reckoned her route and come ahead to wait for her, 9 ravens perched at regular intervals on a power line. She cut the zip ties off Booth Hendrickson and let him use the men's room. She went with him and waited while he washed his hands, and she walked him back to the Explorer. She zip-tied him again, wrist to wrist, and drew the belt as before. Sufficiently confident of her control, she left him alone in the SUV. As she walked to the women's facilities, the 9 ravens sat solemn and portentous on the wire, gazing down at her, working their long gray beaks in a mute chorus. When she returned, Hendrickson sat exactly as she had left him, as docile as a good dog, but not as engaged. He spoke only if spoken to, and seemed to be slowly drifting away into an internal landscape from which he might at some point fail to return. She was convinced that his condition had far less to do with a malfunctioning control mechanism than with a psychological withdrawal or disintegration. They continued through the northwest corner of the Mojave, passing out of it at Owens Lake. By the time they reached Lone Pine, where she stopped for fuel and food, they were at an elevation of 3,700 feet and headed toward a different world, with the Sierra Nevada to the west and the Inyo National Forest on both sides. At a diner, she bought takeout, 4 cheeseburgers and 2 Diet Cokes. Hendrickson didn't want any food, but she cut his zip ties again and ordered him to eat, and so he did. The day had grown colder. She kept the engine running while they ate, for heat and music. Arthur Rubinstein playing Beethoven, Sonata No. 21 in C major, Opus 53. This time, she didn't secure his hands. He was drained of all potential for independent action and seemed to be a shell of a man. They returned to the highway with Beethoven's Sonata No. 18 in E-flat major, Opus 31, No. 3, and as they continued north, she found herself wanting only Rubinstein, arguably the greatest pianist who ever lived. It was said that the composer Franz Liszt might have been greater, although he lived before recordings could be made. She understood why only Rubinstein would suit her now. Her destination was a place of such evil that perhaps even if she came back alive, she would come back changed, in some way diminished by the experience. Although she was a pianist of much less talent than Rubinstein, she was able to hear the pure joy with which he played, to feel the joy with which he embraced life, and she wanted to have as much of his music as she could in these last few hours before Tahoe, while she could still be so profoundly moved by it. As the highway led steadily into higher elevations, the sky descended and the sun receded, so that its position could not be discerned behind the uniform gray shroud. A breeze rose, harrying shapes of dust and chaff across the road, stitching the air with dead pine needles. An hour past Lone Pine, as they were approaching Bishop, an electronic highway sign advised that, due to weather conditions ahead, California Highway Patrol required that all vehicles bound for Mammoth Lakes and points north must apply tire chains. She stopped at a service station and bought plastic chains and was third in line to have them installed. Hendrickson had closed his eyes. He seemed to be sleeping. His lips moved as if he were forming words, but no sound escaped him. After the chains were in place, she pulled the SUV aside, but didn't at once return to the highway. Before beginning the final long leg of the trip, she intended to place a quick call to Gavin and Jessica, which was when she learned that her burner phone had lost its charge. In almost 3 months, she had only twice before become so overwhelmed by events that she'd forgotten to keep the cell phone charged. She felt derelict, though the sudden worry that overcame her was excessive, a superstitious response to a simple oversight. Travis would not be taken from her just because she had let the phone go dead. He was safe with Gavin and Jesse. He was happy and safe with his pony and the German shepherds. The charging station was already plugged into the dashboard port, nestled in a cup holder. She fitted the cell phone to it. Depending on weather conditions, she would stop to make the call at either Mammoth Lakes or farther on at the tiny town of Lee Vining. Rubinstein was playing Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, Opus 23, with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. Eyes still closed, Hendrickson whispered, "Heads inside heads, eyes inside eyes." 18. From the restaurant, they return to DuBose's room, where he sits at a small table by an ocean view window to work on the laptop, while Jurgen sits across from him, waiting to hear what idea has managed to fire from synapse to synapse in that bacon-fogged brain.
"Last night, both those chopper jockeys said the Land Rover was last seen heading what direction?"
"Southwest," Jurgen says.
"Southwest," DuBose agrees. "Let's have a look at Google Maps."
Jurgen doesn't want to move his chair around the table and snug it up against DuBose in order to see the screen. He'd feel like a little boy watching Daddy do important things. He stares out at the sparkling Pacific and listens to his partner walk him through it. This is how it progresses. First, Gavin Washington will know what unparalleled resources are available to his pursuers and will suspect he has little time to go to ground before every police car in the state will be on the lookout for a vintage white Land Rover with his plate number. So assume he has a set of forged plates and uses them. The vehicle still is what it is. He remains at risk. This Google map, now that Google map. All right, if Washington doesn't drastically change direction when out of sight of the Hilo crew, he powers through the wilds of the Cleveland National Forest, heading for the county line. He probably crosses over into San Diego County, somewhere between Deluse and Fallbrook, no longer in the National Forest, but in a decidedly rural area. The first paved road he comes to is a county highway, S-13, a two-lane blacktop. An offshoot of S-13 connects with Interstate 15, but he's going to avoid such a heavily patrolled major highway, even in the quiet hours just after dawn. He's going to stay as long as possible on tertiary roads, where he's least likely to cross the path of a cop. He can stay on S-13 past Camp Pendleton, the Marine Corps facility that occupies a big piece of the coast, and then follow a series of county roads that can take him south and east to the international crossing at Tecate.
"He won't try crossing at Tijuana," says Dubose. "He's just too hot for that."
"All of Mexico is too hot for him," Jurgen says. "He and that legless bitch have guns, remember. They won't risk going into Mexico with weapons and wind up being held for ransom by some corrupt federales."
"Exactly right,"
Dubose says, as if he's already thought of the gun problem. So the fugitive's options narrow down like this. First, he's going to want to stay away from major population centers until he has a chance to repaint the Land Rover to make it match whatever color is specified on the forged registration, after which he will be less likely to draw police attention, which means that he must have some relatively secluded location where this can be done. He will most likely go inland, into San Diego County's least populated territory, and there's a lot of it. He might make his way south on S-13 and then switch to the first eastbound route, which is State Highway 76, a more significant road than S-13, though still tertiary. Because S-13 follows the east perimeter of Camp Pendleton, there will be military-based security cameras at points along that length of the highway. Jurgen fetches his laptop from his room, returns with it, and plugs it in. He slips into the NSA's massive data trove through a back door with which Arcadians in the agency have provided him. He summons archived video from Pendleton's S-13 cameras during the early hours of this morning. He fast-forwards in search of a southbound vintage Land Rover. Meanwhile, Dubose is considering State Highway 76, which passes through some lonely territory to the east. He soon finds two points of interest along that route. 19. The little blue stucco house was as humble inside as out. During the building of the bunker and associated structures, Cornell lived here, overseeing the Filipinos, whose language he'd learned. In addition to his talent for devising hugely popular apps, he had a talent for languages. He spoke 6 fluently. The living room, study, one of 2 bedrooms, and kitchen were furnished with discount warehouse goods that were mismatched but serviceable.
"It sure is dusty," Travis said,
as he followed Gavin and Jesse through the house, while the dogs explored on their own with the usual canine curiosity.
"He never comes here anymore," Gavin said. "Every month, when I visit, I check the place, you know. Make sure there aren't plumbing problems, water leaks, confirm that all the appliances are working. But I never have time to do much house cleaning."
"Or inclination," Jesse said. She wiped a finger across a kitchen counter and held it up to reveal a beard of dust.
"We can have it tidy in no time," Gavin said. "We'll tie rags to the dog's tails. And this boy here, why, we can work him till he drops, while we sit on the porch with glasses of iced tea."
"That's bourgeois for sure," Travis said.
20. Sequined with sunshine, the sea glimmers to shore in rhythmic waves and breaks on the alabaster beach in boas of sparkling foam. While on this side of the window, Carter Jurgen fast-forwards through video of the county road along the eastern flank of Camp Pendleton until he freezes an image in early light.
"Got him. Right here it is. The same freaking Land Rover.
I'll be damned if it isn't. Of course it is, DuBose says.
He doesn't bother to look when Jurgen turns the laptop toward him, as though his theory of Gavin Washington's actions could not possibly be proven wrong, as though Jurgen has been given make-work to keep him busy while DuBose does the heavy thinking.
Meanwhile, DuBose says, I've been studying State Highway 76. If he's got some private place, some rural hidey-hole he's headed for, that's the route he's most likely to take. You'll find two cameras at the junction of 76 and County Highway 16 at the town of Pala.
Pala?
I never heard of Pala. It's a little pissant town, but they have one of the early California missions there, and it's been restored. It's considered worth surveilling the intersection there to have after-the-fact evidence in case of terrorism. I don't know why.
All the missions are of historic value, Jurgen says.
Petrified dinosaur dung is of historic value, but we don't keep a camera on every pile of it.
Jurgen is appalled, but it's not the first time a statement by DuBose has appalled him.
Well, ISIS and all those off-with-your-head types love to destroy historic buildings and erase the past. What matters to me is the now, DuBose opines. I live in the now. Anyway, check out those Pala cameras. They'll be in the NSA archives, too. See if the rover went by there within maybe half an hour of when it should have turned off S-13.
Jurgen needs 10 minutes to retrieve an image of the Land Rover passing the junction of State Highway 76 and County Highway S-16. This kind of catch always thrills him. It's like magic.
Got him, he declares. Of course you do, says DuBose, again ignoring Jurgen's laptop to focus on what he's doing on his own. Now, about 14 miles past Pala. County Highway 6 turns north off Highway 76 to the even tinier pissant town of Palomar Mountain. Two low-profile cameras at the junction, because of Palomar Observatory. Again, don't ask me why.
They have the 200-inch Hale telescope, Jurgen says. It's an important national asset. They study the stars, the universe.
The stars haven't changed in, like, several million centuries. Says here Palomar opened in the 1930s. If they need so many years to study what never changes, then some of these guys are sitting around up there smoking weed and jerking off.
Sometimes it seems as if perhaps DuBose says things he doesn't really believe, just to see if he can get Jurgen to pop a cork. But Jurgen tries his best not to respond in a way that will give the hillbilly hulk satisfaction. Without responding, he seeks out the archived video from the cameras at the highway junction south of Palomar. 21. The cleaning supplies under the kitchen sink were a few years old, but still effective. While Jesse and Travis set about giving the kitchen a preliminary scrub, Gavin went through the connecting door into the single-stall garage and turned on the light. Cornell had abandoned his Honda 4 years earlier, when he moved into his secret residence to read through Apocageddon. Since then, he'd come out only once a week to get his mail. When Gavin visited, Cornell gave him the paid bills to post. Cornell no longer drove anywhere. In spite of his millions, he had purchased the car used. Though 12 years old, its odometer registered only 47,566 miles. According to Cornell, he'd driven less than 2,000 of those, traveling in and out of Borrego Springs to shop at Center Market and Desert Pantry during the construction of his end-of-the-world bunker. He didn't like to drive. He felt the speed at which an automobile could travel was deeply unnatural. On his once-a-month visits, Gavin had looked after the Honda, keeping it in good running order, against the day when his cousin might decide that society wasn't going to collapse after all. Ever since he and Jesse had taken in Travis, he'd had another reason to take care of the sedan, so they could use it in a pinch. After he had driven the Honda out of the garage and parked it beside the house, the fullest recognition of what had happened hit him. He needed to sit for a while in the yard, on the stump of an Indian laurel that had been cut down ages ago, in the shade of the palm trees planted later. If their comfortable life wasn't gone forever, it was gone for at least as long as Jane's crusade lasted, and perhaps longer. If she failed, their lives would not only be less comfortable, but would unspool day after day in an atmosphere of tension, even dread. Of course, if Jane failed, not just he and Jesse, but most of the country, in time, most of the world, would fall into a darkness without exit. 3 months earlier, he would not have found credible the notion of a future in which an elite class with unprecedented power ruled a fearful population, some enslaved by nano-implants, others intimidated into obedience by the millions who were thus programmed. Those millions could in minutes be transformed from your friendly neighbors into ruthless killers who would slaughter anyone identified as a rebel, including their own parents, even their own children. Now, he was finding it difficult to believe that such a future would not happen. By comparison, an army of the walking dead would be a feeble force. He and Jesse had believed enough in the need to defend freedom that they'd given years of their lives, and Jesse her legs, to the fight. They were grateful for each other, for their life after war. To have it upended now seemed almost too much to endure. Not that they would fail to endure it. They were good at enduring. Adversity was the touchstone by which they proved their value to themselves. He knew what Jesse would say, because she had said it before. Nobody ever promised me that life would be a party. As long as I have you to laugh with and hope with, nothing can defeat me. He felt the same way. Nevertheless, when he got up from the tree stump, he turned in a circle, surveying the day, and he knew that everything that seemed so solid and eternal was in fact fragile. The bleached denim blue of the desert sky, the queen palms with their feathery pendant fronds, the great flatness of desert soon to be flowering all the way to the distant mountains. All of it might seem mundane, but it was, in truth, astonishing if you took the time to think about it. Precious beyond any price. Every place in the world a fantastic dream that had been given substance. But you could wake from it when you woke into death, or now into a life of nano-implant slavery. He pulled the Land Rover into the garage and closed the big tilt-up door. In a day or two, he would put together a simple spray booth from a little lumber and a lot of plastic sheeting and paint the Rover blue. Now, he went back into the house to shave his head. 22. Although Carter Jurgen is keen to get Travis Hawk and use the boy to bring the mother to her knees, he almost wishes that DuBose is proved wrong, that the cameras at the turnoff to the Palomar Observatory will not reveal the Land Rover. If the Washingtons have somehow pulled off a disappearing act between Paula and Palomar, what a pleasure it will be to see the West Virginia Yeti gape-mouthed and bewildered. But no, there it is, the target vehicle, motoring past Palomar.
"About 12 miles farther," DuBose pontificates. "Highway 76 terminates in Highway 79. From there, maybe they went south on 79. There are 2 low-profile cameras at Santa Isabel, related to the mission there, the Santa Isabel Asistencia. Check it out."
"You could have been checking it out while I was reviewing the Palomar video," Jurgen observes, in as neutral a tone of voice as he can manage.
"I'm thinking. I'm looking at the maps and thinking. Someone has to do the thinking," DuBose says.
After a while, Jurgen has a report to make.
"They should have passed through Santa Isabel maybe half an hour after Palomar. I've fast-forwarded through 90 minutes of video. No Land Rover. Have you been thinking? We need more thinking."
I never stop thinking, DuBose says. I wish we had a few more of these stupid missions in the area, but we don't. That's okay. I'm on it. Stand by.
Stand by?
I've got an idea shaping up, DuBose says.
The big man sits before his laptop, shoulders straight, head raised, chin jutting forward, his expression almost a parody of what a man might look like when he is full of virtuous purpose.
Damn if it doesn't seem as if he's trying to look like Dudley Do-Right.
23. The breeze died just before the clouds began to shed large, pillowy flakes that spiraled in their descent, floating across the hood of the Explorer, streaming up the windshield without touching the glass, caught in the vehicle's slipstream. Like a cold smoke, snow at first eddied across the pavement, but then it began to stick. By the time that she reached the town of Lee Vining, Jane had to reduce speed, whereupon she needed the windshield wipers. The metronomic thump of the rubber blades and the monotone song of the tire chains hashed Rubinstein, so she switched off the music. She pulled off the road and stopped in the parking lot of a convenience store. When she picked up the disposable phone, which was now charged, Hendrickson rose out of his self-cast spell and regarded the instrument with interest. He met her eyes as she prepared to key in the number of the burner that she'd left with Gavin and Jesse. Then he looked down at the 12-button display. His eyes were not the slick white of hard-boiled eggs, as in her dream, but there seemed to be an unwholesome curiosity in them, as if, on some level, he knew that he should still be her enemy, even if he could not act against her. "Look away," she said, to be sure that he wouldn't see the number she meant to call. Instead, he met her eyes again. "Look away," she repeated. He turned his face to the window in the passenger door. Maybe because of the remoteness of this place, or because of the storm, she couldn't get service. She would have to try later, though they were heading into even more remote territory and worse weather. She might have to delay calling until she crossed the border into Nevada and reached Carson City. She drove back onto 395 in the wake of a highway department truck fitted with an enormous plow that skimmed the pavement. The rotating yellow beacons flung waves of light through the gray, alchemizing the falling snow into gold. Still gazing out the side window, Hendrickson said,
"They'll find him."
"Find who?" There was no note of triumph or animosity in his flat voice, only a somber statement of what he believed to be fact.
"They'll find your son."
As if she were a stringed instrument that fate was tuning for a performance, Jane felt something tighten in her chest. "What would you know about it?"
"Not much. The boy wasn't my primary focus, but recently..."
"Recently what?"
"They doubled the number of searchers looking for him."
"What else?" "You know something else. Tell me."
"No. Just that. Twice as many people chasing down leads."
"They'll never find him," she said.
"It's inevitable."
Irrationally, she wanted to draw her pistol and whip the barrel across his face, but she had nothing to gain and much to lose by indulging that desire. There was nothing worse she could do to him than what she'd already done. As he faced forward again, she said, "What was your primary focus?"
"Finding you."
"How did that work out?" After a silence, he said,
"I don't know yet."
24. Radley DuBose's idea is that if the Washingtons didn't go south on Highway 79, which the archived video from Santa Isabel confirms that they did not, then they must have gone north. Jurgen restrains himself from congratulating his partner on the brilliance of deducing the or in this either-or choice.
"But they wouldn't have gone far north on 79, DuBose says.
peering into his laptop screen as though into a crystal ball.
Because all that does is take them back to Orange County by a roundabout route. They weren't just out for a pleasure drive.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
But the only road that connects with the entire northern leg of 79 is County Highway 2.
Therefore,
they switched on to Highway 2. But that road goes south to the Mexican border, and I already figured out they won't try crossing the border with guns.
Was it you who figured that out? Jurgen asks. DeBose isn't listening closely enough to hear the subtle sarcasm in his partner's voice.
However, Highway 2 doesn't just go south. It offers them a binary choice.
Another either-or to test the clever sleuth.
Just as Highway 2 takes a sharp turn south, it intersects with County Highway 22. So it's a damn good bet they took 22 east, which goes all the way across the Anza-Borrego Desert to Salton City by the Salton Sea.
Salton City by the Salton Sea sounds like a song title, says Jurgen.
But if they wanted to go to the Salton Sea, they would have gone south on 79 to 78 to 86, because those were all much better roads than 22.
All these numbers, Jurgen says, are making my pretty head spin. So what is your conclusion? 22 only leads two places.
Salton City is at the end of it. And before that, Borrego Springs.
Maybe we go to Borrego Springs and see what there is to see. DeBose looks up from his laptop.
Didn't I just say that? It's 113 miles. We can be there in 2 hours.
Jurgen takes his laptop. DeBose leaves his in the room, and they go downstairs to the hotel's front entrance. The day is warm, and the palm trees tower majestically, and there are white gulls kiting high in the silence of the clear blue sky. The valet confirms that an hour earlier, a gentleman named Harry Lime had delivered a vehicle for their use. It came on a flatbed truck. He declares that it is one of the most amazing vehicles any of the valets has ever seen. NSA personnel have replaced the two shotgunned tires, washed the Velociraptor, and waxed it. The truck looks fabulous. DeBose drives. 25. In a barren condition, Gavin's head wasn't nearly as smooth as that of his cousin. It had topography. He returned to the kitchen from the bathroom, frowning as he slid a hand over his naked skull.
I've got a bumpy head.
Probably from all the times I've had to knock some sense into you, Jesse said. Travis said,
Uncle Gavin, you look like Vin Diesel.
The Fast and Furious guy?
I guess you mean it as a compliment, but I'm not sure I'd have shaved off my hair if I'd known I've got a bumpy head.
Everyone's got a bumpy head, Jesse assured him. That's why phrenologists have something to read when they read your head.
Cornell's head is smooth as an egg.
Well, that's not the only thing different about Cornell.
I'm not sure what I'm going to look like with a beard.
Hey, Aunt Jessie. The dogs are shedding a lot right now, Travis said. We could save some dog hair and glue it to Uncle Gavin's chin.
Now that's genius, Trav. We run that hand vac over Duke and Queenie, we'll have more than enough hair. We can glue it tonight. Get a preview of what my man will look like in a few weeks. The dogs had taken a special interest in Gavin, sniffing around his feet and up his pant legs, as though trying to determine if, like Samson after Delilah, he'd lost something more when he'd lost his hair. To Jesse, he said,
We've got to go in town to food shop. So why don't you start your makeover now? Give me a chance to fire a little mockery back at you.
Fire too much, and you'll have nothing for dinner but what the dogs get. After Jesse went into the bedroom, where they'd left their luggage, Travis said,
We wiped off the whole kitchen, Uncle Gavin. Now we have to wipe out inside the cupboards. This here is Lysol water. It stinks.
But it stinks good, Gavin said. Why don't you start, and I'll come help in 5 minutes.
Where are you going?
To hide, where you can't find me.
The boy grinned.
I'll find you all right. Duke and Queenie, with their noses, they'll find you all the way to Mars.
When Gavin went into the living room, he discovered that Jessie had anticipated him. She handed him the burner phone that Jane had given them. This is gonna hit her hard, baby.
Don't I know it?
He took the disposable phone onto the front porch and closed the door behind him. He dreaded having to tell Jane, having to add to whatever hell she was currently dealing with, but he wanted to get this done. Apparently, she was, at the moment, somewhere that didn't have cell service. He couldn't reach her. 26. At Oceanside, DuBose exits Interstate 5 and enters State Highway 76, heading east. They have traveled perhaps 25 miles when he says,
There you go.
There I go what? Jurgen asks. Pointing through the windshield, DuBose says,
That's County Highway 16 ahead on the left. The turnoff for Pala, the place you never heard of, where there's a restored mission. See that pole? The cameras are on top of that pole just like I told you they were. Low-profile cameras, so you hardly know they're up there.
He slows the Velociraptor.
It's exactly like I told you. And then you went to the video, and the rover had gone past, just like I said. That's when Jane Hawk's rampage began to come to an end. When the threat she posed began to unravel.
He sounds as though he must be rehearsing for his role in some documentary that the Techno-Arcadians will make, after their triumph, to glorify their ascendancy to total power. DuBose accelerates.
About 14 miles ahead, on the left, is County Highway 6, which goes to Palomar Mountain. That's one more important milestone in the events leading up to the historic capture of Travis Hawk and the surrender of his mother.
Carter Jurgen is feeling increasingly cranky about DuBose's guided tour of this historic journey.
Yeah, well, nobody's captured anybody yet. We'll get the little shit,
DuBose assures him.
I smell him.
Fee-fi-fo-fum, Jurgen says. Wondering if that literary illusion might go over the head of a Princeton man. A short while later, Radley DuBose says,
And there ahead is the turnoff to Palomar Mountain. Two more low-profile cameras high on that pole, even now recording us as I race toward the endgame of this ugly business. Damn it,
Jurgen grieves.
I should be driving. Palomar Observatory, says DuBose, has the 200-inch Hale telescope, an important national asset.
This is too much. Jurgen reminds him of what he'd said earlier, where the astronomers sit around smoking weed and jerking off.
Might very well be the case, my friend, but I'd advise you not to say such a thing publicly. You'll only be mocked and derided. And the powers that be will decide you are seriously unserious.
27. When Jane had left the makeover items, Jessie had doubted that anyone would fail to recognize her in such a getup. But regarding herself in the bathroom mirror, she admitted that, as usual, Mrs. Hawk had known what she was doing. She returned to the kitchen. Her straight black hair pinned under a modified afro wig, which worked because her multi-ethnic heritage left her with a café au lait complexion, allowing that she might have a trace of Africa somewhere in her roots. Her Irish green eyes were hidden behind contacts that turned them brown. Travis said,
Aunt Jessie, you look great this way too.
You do, Gavin agreed. It's suddenly like my wife's out of town and here's this total fox.
Oh, baby, now that's just the kind of thing a foolish man says, thinking he'll score some points. Gavin grimaced.
Heard myself saying it? Couldn't believe I was saying it. What I think happened is I was for a moment possessed by the spirit of a really stupid man.
They had come now to a moment that made Jessie uncomfortable, but she couldn't figure a way to get around it. They were going to leave Travis alone for an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. He had 2 canisters of Saber 5.0 pepper spray, of a strength used by law enforcement, which they'd trained him to use when he first came to live with them. He would have the dogs, who adored him and were vigilant and protective by breed and training. Although he was not yet 6, the boy was at least as responsible as the average 10-year-old. The house would be securely locked. It was broad daylight. Borrego Valley had virtually 0 crime, in part because more than 1/3 of the population was over 65, and the median age was maybe 57, 58. In the years that the house had stood empty except for Gavin's monthly visits, there had never been a break-in or vandalism. Travis was arguably safer here than he would be with them. And yet, Jesse worried. The plan was to shop for food and other necessities that would get them through a month. Even with their appearance altered, she and Gavin didn't want to be venturing into Borrego Springs on a regular basis. In a town that small, with a population of less than 4,000, new people would be noticed quickly, especially new black people, considering that the black population was about 1%. The less they showed themselves, the better. And if no one saw them with Travis, they wouldn't match any description of 2 fugitives with a child. They were regular folks, probably campers, RV types, visiting Borrego Springs for a few weeks. There was every reason to think they couldn't have been tracked to this relatively remote place. The traffic monitors and public space surveillance cameras that were ubiquitous in urban and even suburban areas, as well as on interstate highways and major state freeways, had not yet been installed on back roads or in places as small and as out of the way as Borrego Springs. Nevertheless, if Gavin went shopping alone, there would be times when he would be distracted and when both his hands would be occupied with one task or another. He would be vulnerable, and in their current circumstances, every moment of vulnerability was an invitation to death. At all times, one of them must have a hand on a gun. Jesse could do that by pushing the shopping cart that Gavin filled, keeping her pistol in her open purse. Although it might be unlikely that he would be spotted and pursued during his first visit to town, minimal prudence required that Jesse go with him and remain at all times aware of their surroundings. They were in a war now, and no one could fight a war alone. There was Cornell in his library, but poor Cornell, stressed by Gavin's recent visit, had asked him to leave and would not have recovered enough to welcome the boy this soon. "You'll be okay here for 2 hours," she assured Travis, though it made her stomach turn to think of him here by himself.
"I know," the boy said. "I'll be okay."
"Don't answer the door if anyone knocks."
"I won't."
"Stay away from the windows."
"I will, Aunt Jessie."
"Nobody's going to break in, sweetie."
"Okay."
"I know." "If someone does break in, which they won't, let the dogs deal with them."
"All right. I will."
"If the dogs can't deal with them, which they will, they'll tear them up all right, but if they can't, only then should you use the pepper spray."
"I know how."
"Once you've sprayed them in the face, run like hell, out of the house. Go to that barn door, sweetie. Cornell will know, and he'll let you in." She looked at Gavin. "Won't he let Travis in?"
"Of course he will."
She could tell from her husband's expression that he wasn't 100% certain what Cornell would do.
"You'll hardly know we're gone, honey. We'll be back in no time."
Travis sighed.
"I'm not a 2-year-old, Aunt Jessie."
She knelt and hugged him and said, "I love you, Trav."
"I love you too, Aunt Jessie."
She might have spent another 10 minutes reassuring the boy if Gavin hadn't said,
"Jess, you might not know this, but Bigfoot has never been seen in this area, and Godzilla is in Japan."
Jessie got to her feet.
"You'll be fine, sweetie."
The boy said,
"So will you."
Gavin saluted Travis.
"Hold the fort, Lieutenant. We'll be back with the beer at 1400.
Holding the fort, sir,
Travis replied, returning the salute. When they stepped onto the back porch, Travis engaged the deadbolt and waved at them through the dust-filmed window in the door, a hazy figure beyond the dirty glass, as if he were already fading out of their lives. 28. This was surely the last storm of the season, and a late one at that, but nature worked hard at it, as though she'd taken a dislike to spring and intended to double down on winter. In the absence of wind, the small flakes fell in skeins, layering veils across the face of the day, ramparts of evergreens, black in the hours-long twilight of the storm, stepped steeply up from the highway, obscured to such an extent that they looked less like masses of trees than like the bastions and battlements of castles. Jane was aware of Hendrickson staring at her from time to time. When she turned her head to meet his eyes, he at once, and almost shyly, looked away. Regarding his potential for violence, her estimation of him had proved correct. Neither had he made an attempt to escape, nor given any indication that he might be contemplating one. He remained as obedient as a machine, just as she had made him. The effort to keep the highway open had been joined by road graders fitted with plows. They moved through the whitewashed day like raw-boned prehistoric creatures with phosphorescent stares. Trucks followed the plows, spreading salt across the pavement. In spite of tire chains, or because it lacked them, a vehicle occasionally slid into a roadside ditch or into a snowbank, where it was either abandoned or attended to by a tow truck driver trying to free it. Hendrickson whispered, "The more it snows, the more it goes, the more it goes on snowing." And though he smiled wistfully, tears tracked down his cheeks. Jane suspected he was quoting from another poem he had learned in childhood, but she didn't ask. Beyond the fact of his being now one of the adjusted people, his condition was so grotesque and his demeanor so disturbing that she didn't want to be drawn further into his orbit than was necessary. She yearned for the company of her child. Instead, she found herself entangled with this strange man-child, whose tortured history included being both the victim of abuse and the vicious abuser of others. And his demonic potential was still within him, still there to be called forth by anyone who discovered he'd been injected with a control mechanism and who knew how to command him. At 1:10 p.m., about an hour and a half later than she expected, she arrived at U.S. Highway 50, a couple miles south of Carson City, and turned west toward Lake Tahoe. Ahead, at a highway department marshaling yard, road clearing equipment lined up to be refueled. She pulled off the highway, stopped, and made another attempt to call the Washingtons. When she picked up the burner phone, Hendrickson turned his head away without being told to do so. He covered his eyes with his hands, like a small child seeking approval by doing more than was asked of him. This time, she got service. Down there in Orange County, the phone rang. Showers of snow ticked against the windshield, and the midday dusk seemed to darken by the moment, and the phone rang. 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 There could be a good reason why neither Gavin nor Jesse took the call. It didn't necessarily mean trouble. There could be many good reasons. Nevertheless, when she terminated the call and returned the disposable phone to the cup holder, her palms were damp with sweat. 29. Travis wasn't scared about being alone. He really wasn't. His dad had been a Marine, and his mom was FBI. He was a Marine FBI kid. The dogs were with him. They had teeth like sabers. They could rip up anyone. They wouldn't rip up him, but they for sure would rip up anyone who ought to be ripped up.
and he had the pepper spray. He could protect the dogs if it came to that. He was not as little as he looked. He had an Exmoor pony that he rode,